April 5th of 2011. I have a home group. It's the Benicia Men's on Wednesday nights, 12 by 12. And I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and they stay in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sponsor guys in the rooms as well. You know, I got sober in Fairfield, actually, at the Into Action Fellowship. And people would tell me to come check out the Benicia Men's meeting. One of them was a stand-up Mike would say it. I would see him at On the Rocks in Fairfield, and he would mention that meeting. Him and Mike Giusto would mention that meeting to me. And it was pretty funny. Initially, I thought those guys, Mike G and Stand Up, they were like these AA gods to me back in the days. You know, there was a time where I had a sponsor. His name was Craig. Craig had a sponsor. His name was Ron. Ron had a sponsor. His name was Wayne. Wayne had a sponsor. His name was Bill Griffin. Rest in peace. Bill Griffin had a sponsor named Gary Burton. Gary Burton's sponsor was Stand Up Mike. So Mike was on this high totem pole that I would look up to him, and I gravitated towards these guys in the rooms. You know, I'm going to start off talking about a little bit about step one without going too much into detail. There's a couple of instances that came to mind. You know, it was March 8th of 2009. It was my wife's birthday. Before I left to work that morning, she looked me in my eyes. She told me she loved me. She told me that her only wish for today is that I do not drink. Please do not drink. She told me how much she loves me. She gave me a big old hug. And I swore to her that I wouldn't drink that day. And I believed it. I believed in every fiber in my bones that I'm not going to pick up today. And I was working in Sacramento at the time. I live in Fairfield, right there in Cordelia. And I made it to about Vacaville, right where that Travis Credit Union is. And if you go a little bit past that, there's a liquor store over there. And there would be this lady who would have what I drank in the mornings waiting in a freezer, in a refrigerator. It wasn't in a refrigerator before, but because I would frequent that place at 6:30 in the morning, she started putting it in there. And I felt the desperation at that moment. Walking in there, I knew, and I was thinking about my wife the whole time while I was going into that liquor store. And while I was driving from Vacaville to Sacramento, I polished off that pint around lunchtime. I was trying to function, right? And I went to work. I did some work the best I could. Picked up another pint around lunchtime. And on the way home, I picked up another pint. And I stopped at Rayleigh's in Fairfield. And I picked up some flowers. And I had these gifts that I had bought my wife. And I walked in through the door. And she had this big old grin on her face. She came running towards me. And I kind of stumbled in and said a few words. And right away, that smile turned into a mask of horror. And I took time picking out those flowers too, and the vase and everything. I put a lot of thought into all that stuff because I love my wife, and I wanted to make her day special, and I tried everything I could to make her day special. And when she realized that I had been drinking, she grabbed the flowers, all the gifts, everything that I had, took it straight outside and threw it in the trash. And she said, you know, you ruined my day again. And I didn't talk to her the rest of her birthday. And that's how a lot of my days were at that time. You know, it was building up. There's so much effort that I would put into achieving these goals. Whether it's a job, I would dress up in a suit like this. I would do my research on the company, look up their mission statement. I'd put together this resume that was immaculate. I would practice in front of the mirror speaking. I would even get some of my friends or people I knew to sit down while they would ask me mock interview questions, and I would answer them. Then I would go to these interviews and I would get these jobs, and then I would show up to work drunk and I would get fired. And I would get blacklisted from these companies where they told me, you can never work for this company again. So all the work that you put into school, all the work effort you put into these positions, it gets me nowhere, right? I keep hitting this wall and I don't know what to do, right? The relationship I was in prior to my wife, you know, I was with this beautiful woman and she was innocent, young and innocent, my age. She was a first cousin of one of my best friends. I swore to him, I'm gonna treat her like a queen. I'm gonna do everything I can to make this relationship work. Thought she was the one. And I'm getting drunk and I'm turning into this other person. And I'm yelling out profanities at her. And that sense of security I'm supposed to bring to the person that I say I care about and I wanna be with, it's just not there because I turn into this monster, right? Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, our literature talks about. So just a couple of examples of powerlessness and unmanageability. You know, I like to describe my drinking in three stages, and I'm sorry if you've heard me talk about this before, but from the time I took my first drink at the age of 13, a shot of Canadian Club whiskey at a wedding reception, up until around the age of 19, I drank with impunity. I didn't have too many repercussions. Things happened in my life, but I didn't get in trouble for them, I could say. And I had a lot of people that stopped me from hitting rock bottom. If my parents would have told me back in when I was 14 or 15, you need to get it together. You're not listening to us. You're gonna get out. You're gonna get out of the house right now. You know, if they said that to me, I have no doubt in my mind I'd be wandering the streets or I'd be dead right now. I didn't realize that. I didn't have any humility when I first got here. When I saw shopping carts pulled up to Into Action Fellowship, I looked down on those people. I thought I was better than them. I thought, what am I doing in a place like this? There was this one time that, and this happened in 2010. Actually, it was the beginning of 2011. I'd have been married about 3 years. And my father-in-law had come to pick up my wife. And he's picking her up because they found out how I was drinking and tormenting her and just destroying our relationship. And a one-month-old baby was caught in the crossfire. So they came and picked, my father-in-law picked her up. And I remember as they were backing away from the driveway, the only thought in my mind was, there's a beer inside the house between the mattresses, and I'm gonna drink that. As soon as they leave, I'm gonna drink that beer. So this mental obsession that they talk about in the doctor's opinion, it outweighs anything, any love that I have for anything in this world. Powerlessness and unmanageability for me was not being able to pick and choose who I drink with, where I drink, what I drink, and how much. You know, it ceased to be a luxury, Bill says, right? And I could relate to everything in Bill W.'s story today. When I read it today, and I highlighted all those things in my literature where the first time I read it, there were some similarities, but now when I go through it, I'm him to a T. There's not anything that is really different. Maybe circumstances, maybe ethnicity, race, or something like that, but as far as the alcoholism and the disease of alcoholism, I'm identical to what he was. Me drinking Taka vodka at 6 in the morning was Bill W. with his bathtub gin. And there's no difference there. It's identical. I remember, so I came into the rooms in 2010 for the first time. I tried it to appease my in-laws and to appease my parents. We had an intervention with all my family once. We had an intervention with all my wife's family once. And I didn't realize how badly I was affecting everyone. I thought I was just affecting myself. You know, now if I look back on it, my wife, she was aging before my eyes. Her hair was graying. She was gaining weight. She looked aged. Her face looked like she was a lot older than she actually was. My mom was suffering from insomnia. Her face was always swollen. She had these puffy eyes from crying all the time. My dad, his blood pressure was high all the time. We were rushing him to the ER at times. My brother would be cussing me out because he said, "You're making him worry." And a couple of times he fell down, he collapsed at the house, and his blood pressure was so high they had to call the ambulance. And as soon as he left, I'm drinking again. My sister, along with my wife, they both started attending Al-Anon together. My brother started attending Al-Anon, and my sister was also seeing a therapist. My wife went to a therapist, and that's just my direct household. I got managers at work that are covering for me because I've developed friendships with them. I have coworkers that are covering up for me. They're doing my work for me. They're getting behind in their own work because they're covering up for me. And then we have my wife's family, where we have my my wife's mom, who moved her family away from England because there was a pub on every corner, and because my wife's grandfather was an alcoholic, and he was a raging alcoholic that would throw things and break things around the house, and so she moved the family away from England to be here, and they were successful. You know, all three of their sons. None of them really drink. They're not alcoholics. And my wife, you know, they're all seem like a pretty normal family. They're successful until they meet this guy, right? And then I somehow infiltrate their family. And now those same worries come back, and the mom's going through the same things and reliving her childhood with her own dad. And you know, they hated me with a passion. They told my wife that if you ever go back to him, we're gonna disown you. You're not going to be welcome in this house ever again. So there was a moment, you know, steps 2 and 3, they talk about came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, and then making a decision. So in April of 2011, I collapsed, fell down to my knees in this retreat that we had upstairs, where there was an empty crib with empty baby toys laying around, and there was vodka bottles laying around. And I would go into this room and I would drink in the dark, right? Because my wife had left by then. The baby wasn't there anymore. And I would be thinking about my own demise. I would be planning my own demise. And I collapsed down to my knees in that room. And I begged and pleaded with something to take that obsession away. I didn't say it like that. You know, it was something along the lines of, "Please, God, help me," right? And thankfully, when I did go walk into the Into Action Fellowship back in 2010, there was this phone list I had, and it had telephone numbers on there. And some of those guys, when I would be walking into that fellowship, they would tell me, I would go there with my wife, and she was pregnant at the time, and they would tell her, and me, that baby never has to see you drink. There was this one old timer, and he would share that every time he was up at the podium. He would say, "My daughter's 17 and she's never seen me drink." And I couldn't believe it. It was like, I would think he's lying. It's not possible, right? There was two gentlemen from the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was showing up to the meetings drunk. They drove me home. They consoled my wife. They talked to my mom and dad. They talked to my sister. They gave them their telephone number, and then they stayed in contact with them. "How's he doing today?" They checked in with them in the morning. "How's he doing? Is he awake? Has he had anything to drink? Okay, we're coming over," right? North Bay Hospital. I was in that emergency room on the regular. I would end up there, and there was a point in time where they just stopped. Nobody wanted to take me anymore because I was there all the time. They said, call the ambulance yourself, right? Which is what they needed to do, right? It was hard for them, but that's what they needed to do. And members of Alcoholics Anonymous showed up to the emergency room, and nobody in my family wanted to come see me anymore. They were done with me, right? AA was the last house on the block. And I remembered those things in 2011. So when I called one of those gentlemen and told him what was going on in my life, he said, okay, are you ready to do this now? I said, yes, I am. And he asked me a question. He said, are you willing to go to any length to stay sober? And I told him, yes. I didn't know exactly what that entailed. And this gentleman, when he would share from the podium, the doctor's opinion talks about depth and weight. That means as an alcoholic, I have to believe what they're saying, right? It has to make sense to me, and I have to believe what they're saying. What he used to share about held depth and weight. He talked about, number one, he talked about drinking Taka vodka at 6:30 in the morning. I thought I was the only one in the world that did that. And he talked about how he had a boat, he had a house, he had a wife, he had all these things, and he lost them all. And then he was walking around on North Texas Street pushing a shopping cart. And I couldn't believe that. I couldn't fathom that man standing there, who seemed like he was the richest guy in the world to me, because he had found the solution to something I had been looking for my entire life. And I couldn't fathom that he was homeless just a few years before. And I sat with that man every day, and we read out of that big book. I spent my first Father's Day as a dad alone. I wasn't alone. I was with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He invited me to his house, and we read. And I was crying. I didn't know how to feel. I kept saying, I'm gonna get some other phone. She had blocked my number by that time. I said, let me use your phone, please. I want to give her a call. He said, no, don't do that right now. You know, give it time. She told you don't call. So my suggestion is do not call, right? And as I started meeting with him on the regular, we started reading through each one of those chapters from the very beginning of the book. And there was a moment where we kneeled down and we did that third step prayer together. And it was similar to what I had done when I fell to my knees in that retreat in our house. But this time I felt like there was some kind of energy that was within me. And I didn't feel like taking my own life so much. There was this momentum building up in my life where I started feeling like I was somewhat of a man of worth. He also made a statement. He said, you may never see your wife again. You may never see your son again, but you could still live a happy and purposeful life. And I couldn't believe that at that time. But something made me keep taking his suggestions. And right around the time I started doing my fourth step inventory and writing down all these resentments, fears in my sexual inventory, it felt like I was putting on a new pair of glasses. Before I had even, the moment the pen started touching paper and there was this sense of clarity, right? I'm probably about 30 days sober now, and I'm not, that's the longest time of sobriety I ever had in my life up to that point. There's this clarity building up, and I'm attending meetings regular, 2 to 3 meetings a day, and I'm hearing all these profound things from all of you. And that new pair of glasses, it allowed me to look at everything on that list in a different way. The people that I thought were tormenting me, that were monsters in my life, our literature says to look at them like they're sick human beings, right? Including my own dad. I'd like to touch on that one. Number one resentment on my list. Turns out, one statement from my sponsor that sounds like your dad is a lot like you without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That changed the way I looked at him. He was just a drunk. He was just a drunk, and he didn't have a solution. So now I could look at him like a human being. He's not a monster, right? I started to send my wife emails because she wasn't talking to me on the phone. And I would send her an email just to tell her what I how I was doing and what I was up to. Not that I'm this many days sober now, and this is what I'm doing. I wouldn't say specifically about this. I might mention that I'm on this step that tells you that this is the suggestion that this step makes, but I wouldn't tell her what it was all about, what I was saying. And then a few months into it, I get this video. My phone's no longer unblocked because I get a text message from her. And it's a video, and it's my son, and he's eating baby food. And man, I must have watched that video 1,000 times. I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I would watch it. It was so strange because I wanted them back so bad, and I wanted to drink at times so bad, but I didn't have to. That's what you guys kept telling me. I don't have to. I remember even when I would be taking a shower, and I would take this picture of my wife and my baby, and I would put it on the counter, and even while I was showering, I would clear off the steam off the shower, and I would look through it, and it would be like they're looking at me, and they're still there. And I would have my screensaver on my laptop open at night, and sometimes I'd wake up and I'd look over to them, and they'd be right there looking at me. And sometimes I'd cry, and sometimes I'd go back to sleep, right? And having to feel these feelings when I'm sober, it was just a completely different experience. My wife, she came back about 5-6 months into it. She came back, and I thought it was going to be just this relationship that I can just start building on, and we're going to live this happy life together all of a sudden. If our relationship became way worse than it ever was when I was drinking, because now it's like, my sponsor would say this thing. He would say, "You created this Frankenstein, now fix it," right? He would make this statement to me. And it was because when we first met, we talked to each other so respectfully when we first met. And over time, F-bombs became the normal, right? And just disrespecting each other, telling each other to shut up became the normal. And I'm trying to stop doing that. But when she comes back, she's still upset. She's still doing those things. So I had to work on that stuff, and I had to practice patience, love, and tolerance. There'd be moments when my car would pull. I felt the most safe when I was in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I would get home, I'd feel like I'm on eggshells. And sometimes I would sit in my car and I'd be on the phone with my sponsor because I didn't want to walk in. I was so terrified of walking in and what's waiting for me and this new responsibility of actually being a father, right? Because I didn't know how to be that. I had no idea how to be a father and how to take care of this child. You guys taught me how to do that. I learned that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my wife struggled quite a bit, you know, even before she left, because even when the baby was born, I didn't drink. I got to witness the baby being born. But just right after the baby was born and brought home, I was drinking. So, and my wife had a C-section, so she was having to go to the crib and pick up the baby because I'm passed out drunk and I'm not helping out when I'm drinking. Terrible, right? So she's back. She's back home. I'm gone all the time. I'm gone to work. I go to Sacramento for work still at the time. At noon I would hit the North Sac group in Sacramento. It was a pretty rough fellowship. I would park my car across the street at the Bank of America because I didn't want to get my rim stolen. And then I would walk across, and I was intimidated. But once people started speaking, the message was the same. The message was identical. It's exactly what I needed to hear. And shortly after that, I got a job in Walnut Creek. When I went over there, I went to a fellowship in Walnut Creek that I would attend regularly at lunchtime, and I felt different there. It felt like different AA initially when I first walked in. I was the only brown guy in the meeting because it's a noon meeting. Everyone's at work. The younger folks seemed like they were all at work. It was a bunch of old timers. They're all Caucasian, and I would go in there and I wouldn't feel like I was the same as them. The moment they started speaking, I felt like I was one of them, right? Language of the heart. And I would hit a meeting in the evening. And after a while, my wife says something. She said, "You're always gone. You're always at meetings." Right? And there would be, because it was like this. I would go to work. I'd go to a noon meeting. I'd go to a 6:30 meeting. I'd go to an 8 o'clock meeting, sometimes even a 10 o'clock meeting. Then I would come home. And I was trying to meet with my sponsor, too, and read out of the literature. And I'm meeting with sponsees now, too, right? And there would be days where I didn't see. I remember there was one time I didn't see my son for 3 days. He was sleeping. I would kiss him when I got home. And then I'd get up and leave to work again. And then I'd do the whole meeting thing again. And she said, "You're not even spending any time with him." So then I had to reevaluate that and kind of look at that. You know, with steps 6 and 7, well, let's get back up a little bit. So that inventory at step 4, once I spoke up about those defects of character, those resentments, that sexual inventory with my sponsor, I felt like this huge weight had been lifted off my shoulders. And I remember he was walking away. He said, "Are you sure there's nothing else?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm sure." And as he's walking away, I don't know, he must have felt my eyes watching him. I kind of turned around and I said, "Hey, there's a couple of more things that I didn't mention. You know, some of those deep, dark things that you don't want to talk about to anybody. And I had swore I'm never going to mention these to anyone." Well, he had my trust at that point. I had spent countless hours with this man up to that point, and I was afraid he was going to leave and I wasn't going to be able to tell him. But when he started walking away, that's this fear, anxiety started kind of building up. So then I opened up about that. And with step 6 and 7, there was this prayer I did every day, and it was to please God, allow me to recognize Dad as a sick human being. That was it. And it didn't start out, it didn't sound so pretty at the beginning when I would say it. It was more of what they call the SOB prayer, right? And I did that probably for a month or two straight for my dad before I was already open to seeing him as a sick person, but I wasn't really ready to forgive him. I had to ask for forgiveness. And I had to ask for the acceptance to do that. And then it eventually came. So the amends I was able to make, you know, same thing with that inventory. Everything's already pretty much written down. And now I get to go out and I get to get right with the world. And I got to approach each individual member of my family just the way it's laid out in the literature. And I would talk to different people at different times. That the good thing about AA is there's different people. I keep this Rolodex in my head, thank God, that when someone says something, and it, as it may pertain to my life, I file it somewhere, right? And then I remember and I approach this person. I remember you talked about this. What did you do in this situation, right? And thankfully, I've gotten, you know, sane answers that relate to the literature so far. And every challenge that's come up, I've been able to get through as a result of that. And you know, I was able to make amends to my mother-in-law, to my father-in-law. I remember the first year. I remember when I got 1 year sober, I was expecting this big celebration where my mother-in-law calls me and she's thanking me for being such a good son-in-law, and I didn't get anything. It was crickets. I was upset. And as the years went by, they started acknowledging it. You know, we have this group thread with all of her family, and now it's like a big thing. My wife bakes me a cake when it's my sobriety birthday, and she'll send pictures to the family. And at this point, I wasn't even really looking for the acknowledgement, and I'm getting it, right? My brother-in-law, this is the oldest one. He's 8 years older than my wife, and he's almost like a father figure at times. He was the older one that I would always take care of her, help her with her homework. And he didn't want anything to do with me. He just came by the house. He was there this weekend. That's why I was a little bit late coming here. His daughter's going to Berkeley now, and he came to drop her off because the year starting on Wednesday, school year. And he spent the whole weekend here. And we have a loving and respectful relationship. And it's like that with my in-laws. My entire with her entire family. You know, we went on a trip to Alaska on a cruise, and it was 19 of her family members, and it was our family, the four of us. I have two boys today. They're 11 years old and 5 years old. And what that old timer said way back when, that child never has to see me drink, has come true. I didn't believe him. That 11-year-old, he was only about a month old when he saw me drink. I'm sure he doesn't remember it. But we got to go on this cruise, and I got to develop a relationship with each and every individual in that family, which I never thought I could have had. She has three older brothers, and like I said, all three of them didn't like me, and now we have different relationships with each and every one of them. But I stay in contact with them regularly. We have this fantasy football league that we do together. We go to games together. We're already making plans for Thanksgiving to go to a football game or a Lakers game when we go out there. And you know, those relationships with people like my dad. My dad has been forgiven. He's the greatest grandfather I could have ever imagined. You know, he plays with those boys, and he has a great time with them. And sometimes I get a little jealous because I wish that he did more of that with us when we were younger. But then I have to remember, hold on, you have to accept people for the way they are. And if I'm looking for forgiveness from the world, I have to give it back to the people that I feel like stepped on my toes. You know, I've gotten so many gifts from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. One thing is that I can be transparent with someone on a level that I could have never imagined. And the more I do that, the men's meeting, my sponsor, I talk to people from the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. You know, there was this point in time where I had my AA life, which was going to meetings and hanging out with you guys and then leaving and not really getting in touch with anyone besides my sponsor. And then he mentioned, you know, you're not really a part of the fellowship. You're not really a part of the fellowship. You're keeping yourself, you're building walls still. You need to knock those walls down. And at some point in time, Alcoholics Anonymous and my personal life, they merged. And today, my best friends are in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We got to go on two retreats this year. One with the Benicia Men's Fellowship, and then another one with a bunch of guys from El Sobrante. And just another opportunity to connect and talk to these guys on a completely different level. I got to go this year to with my sponsor, my grand sponsor, who's currently in Michigan. We got to go visit him out in Michigan, and then we took a road trip out to Akron, and we got to go see that. We went to the Mayflower Hotel, and we got to go take a picture next to the telephone that Bill W. made the call from in the lobby. And we got to go to Dr. Bob's grave, and we got to go to Dr. Bob's home. And there was actually a person from Vacaville that used to live in Vacaville that volunteers at that place now. So we didn't get to connect with them for long, but you know, it's just opened up so many doors in my life today. There's a sense of, I don't walk on eggshells when I pull up to my house anymore. I don't have to wear a different mask everywhere I go. I get to be the same person you see in front of you here now. But one thing is, I can talk to you more honestly than I can talk to my own wife about certain things. Because you guys understand, you won't look at me like I'm crazy. My wife's seen some crazy things, right? She's traumatized to this day. We were at a family function in Sacramento last weekend. And one of my cousins, he's a little bit younger than me, he kept sneaking off to the garage, and he kept slamming a beer can and throwing it away before anybody could see it. And a couple of different people noticed him doing it. And later his wife approached us and she said, can you talk to him? And those kind of things didn't happen before. His parents talked to me and they said, can you talk to him? His parents used to be the ones that would tell me and another cousin of mine to stay away from the rest of them because we were the bad influences. We were the ones that would get locked up. We were the ones that would get in trouble. We were the ones that were truants at school. And now they're coming to us for help, right? It's an honor and a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, to be able to be a father to those two boys, something I could have never imagined. I was so terrified. I remember when she came back home and I would be holding that little baby. I knew in my heart that I'm going to let that child down. That's the way I felt at the time. I felt so sorry for that kid. I said, I would think in my head, you know, you have this piece of shit for a father, and I'm so sorry. That's the thought that would be going through my head, but not anymore. You know, I feel like I am a good father, and you guys taught me how to be that here. I could have never imagined that. There was a time where my younger son was in Little League, and every time he would go up to bat, he would be batting, and he would look back like this to see if I was standing back there. And I just thought to myself, you know, what if I wasn't there? What if I didn't show up and I wasn't standing there when he's going up to bat? And he does the same thing at Taekwondo. He got a blue belt recently, and when he got his belt, first thing he did was look over to me, then he ran over and gave me a hug. So he's always looking at me for approval, you know, and I tell him, you know, I'm proud of you just the way you are. Just keep doing what you're doing. You know, and they're both, well, the older one's a really good kid. The little one's a little naughty, but he's getting better. Yeah, and you know, these kids, they test your patience. I talked about it at the men's meeting the other day about how easy it is to lose our temper with our children sometimes. And I forget that he's just a little five-year-old kid. And last year at school, he's flooding the toilets. He cut some little girl's hair with scissors. And I was like, my sponsor's like, this kid sounds just like you, right? So I'm going to have to watch him. But one thing about this program is I'm so happy that there's this solution that's being passed on from generation to generation. And that there is something there. God forbid my children are afflicted with this disease. There is a solution there. And you know what? There's a couple of people in this room that I have in my Rolodex that have already been through that. You know, they've already been through that. They've told me what their children have been through. And that gives me hope. That gives me hope that even if something like that were to happen, that there's still a solution that can carry on for even another generation going forward. You know, I mentioned early on that I gravitated towards the old timers in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to touch on that a little bit more. When I didn't have a relationship with my dad, these old guys like Mike G and Stand Up, it felt like I was talking to my father, like how my father should have been, how I wanted him to be, right? I'd be sitting with them and they would make me feel this sense of calm. They would bring this confidence to me that I wish was instilled into me when I was a little kid, right? When I was a little kid, around the age of my five-year-old, I was hiding because my dad was raging drunk outside, right? But connecting with these old-timers, they brought me closer to my dad. I give them credit. Obviously, the step worked as well. But leading by example and showing me proper AA etiquette, I used to be the guy that would be outside during the opening prayer, and I'd be smoking a cigarette, and I'd be smoking a cigarette at the end of the meeting before the Lord's Prayer started. I would exit out because the show was over. Now I don't want to hear these end credits, right? And you know, they told me, and they weren't so nice about it. They said get here before the meeting starts, get a commitment, and get to know the people in the rooms. Put your hand out and shake everyone's hand. So if you guys see me, and I usually come into a meeting and I try to shake everyone's hand and greet everyone when I come in. That was something they kind of instilled in me. And they would say things like, put your goddamn cell phone away, right? And I'm so glad I listened to them. One of them even came up and told me, there was three of us standing there, and they said, there's a good chance that two of you won't be here within a year. And guess what? A year later, it was just me standing there. We used to make these names for ourselves, the different groups of friends that I had when we came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Remember, there was four of us. We call ourselves the Four Horsemen. There was three guys. There was one girl. And we would hang out. We'd go out for coffee. And then as one person went out, then all of a sudden it's like paranoid and anxiety again, right? And we were down to the three amigos. And then I was like standing alone. And that's why I started. And then the old timers were always there. They were always there at the meeting. Their cars were always there. I recognized their cars. But right when I pulled up, remember there was this Sunday meeting where I was terrified when I would be worried about the work week because I cut corners the week before, and I would be afraid that it's going to catch up to me on Monday when I go back into the office. So I'd go to this Sunday meeting, and I would recognize the cars there. Okay, Ice Cream Ron's there. This person's here. That person's here. And I would just get this sense of ease and comfort that everything's going to be all right. These guys are here. Everything's going to be all right. And I would walk into those meetings, and I would hear exactly what I needed to hear. You know, and that gift of desperation, thank God for that gift of desperation. You know, it to become willing as only the dying can be. And I was dying. A lot of us were dying when we first came here. You know, how powerful is that statement? To be as willing as only the dying can be. I didn't realize how close I was to that actual final blow. And today, it's a different type of momentum. It's not fear that's controlling my life today. It's not fear that I'm going to go out and pick up a drink. The thought of a drink hasn't crossed my mind in many years today. There's other type of fears. There's financial fear sometimes. There's a fear of the health of my children. And these are healthy fears at times. And when they become unhealthy, I have someone to talk to about it, and I have a game plan on how to address that. And that 10th step is key. It's taking that daily inventory and being transparent. You know, I to this day, I drop down on my knees every morning. I used to say this long-winded prayer, and it was, I would name off every defective character I was asking God to remove. I would state out the seven deadly sins. And I was up, by that time, I was down there, and I was just trying to speed through it so that I can get up and leave to work, right? And I was kind of annoyed. It was like an annoyed kind of prayer that I have to do this. I simplified it. You know, I say, I know I can't. I believe you can, and I believe you will. And please, God, help me stay sober today. And at the end of every night, I'll thank God if I make it through the day. Right? And those are things that I didn't do before. It used to always be the fire extinguisher prayer where, please God, get me out of this. Where I'm looking in the rear view and hoping there's not blue and red lights flashing in the rear view. Right? And so with step 11, prayer and meditation, it became a huge part of my life. When I was commuting back and forth to Sacramento, there was this meditation prayer in Vacaville on Mondays at 6:30. And I would stop off at that meeting, and I would it would be just completely quiet. And I started practicing that. And I started practicing it at home. And today it feels like I can do it anywhere I go. You know, my dad was in a hospital procedure, and they had a meditation room there at Kaiser. And I went into Kaiser and I sat there. Before I know it, an hour passes, and I walk out fearless and not worried about him at all. I know he's going to be taken care of, right? That power doesn't come from me. Without that power that I tap into, I'm this scared person. I'm this scared individual, right? I commute into San Francisco a couple of days out of the week. And when I do, I put on my headphones. It's about an hour ferry ride. And I put on my classical music. And I get into that meditative state, right? I'm really good at meditation when it's structured and I know where I'm going to be that day. But when it's like, okay, you're waking up, the kids are already noisy downstairs, it throws me off. So I have to do, I can always do a better job. I need to do a better job sometimes, right? And then moving on to step 12, the most honest and real that I ever feel like I am is when I'm sitting across the table from another alcoholic and I'm reading out of that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. All of those prior efforts that I made, all of those meetings, everything that I've done in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, every hardship I've ever been through has led up to that moment where I'm sitting across from a newcomer and trying to carry this message, searching for something that, and I mentioned this before, I found a solution that I had been searching for my whole life. I didn't know it was within a few miles of my home. I had no idea. And even if I had known, I probably wouldn't have been ready, because I had to get beaten down to submission, right? To be able to pass that message on and carry that message to other alcoholics, it's such a beautiful thing today. And to be able to see, it talks about being able to see fellowships grow up around me, and that's something we must not miss. I'm so glad I'm not missing it, and I'm able to be a part of it. It's just so uplifting to see families sometimes reunited, sometimes they might not be, but people sustain and they can still live a happy and purposeful life, just like they had told me, right? Blind faith. The flimsy reed turned into the loving and powerful hand of God, right? I never knew what that meant, but I can tell you now. I can feel it just gave me chills saying it right now, because I know exactly what that means. It means that I can tap into something that's going to carry me through anything and everything that happens. And you guys taught me that, you know, and I go to a lot of men's meetings nowadays. I go to co-ed meetings as well. I'm going to be at one today at 6:30. There's a gentleman who celebrated 1 year of sobriety. And I remember a few years ago how badly he was struggling, and he's chairing the meeting today. And we were all texting back and forth about it. And the same thing the old timers would say to me, they would say, don't F it up, and make sure you bring your A game. I was texting him that same stuff and just making him a little bit nervous, shaking him up a little bit. But man, it's just so great. And you know, you guys lead by example. You told me to watch your feet, not your mouths. That's what my sponsorship chain told me. They said, watch our feet. And I've been watching. And those, my sponsor today, he's from the El Sobrante Fellowship. I watch his feet. And he does all the things that he suggests to me. I watch my grand sponsor, who's like old as my dad. He's like 84 years old. When we went to Michigan, we were worried about him. We said, you know, we don't know how many more chances we're going to have to hang out with him and see him. He's getting older. I wonder if he's happy at this fellowship. There was a men's fellowship that had 100 guys there. It had 100 guys there. And me and Jerry were joking. We said that he probably has his picture up on the wall. We walked in there and his picture was on the wall. he's on the board and they have a bunch of their pictures on there. So he's just fine. You know why he's just fine? Because he tapped into Alcoholics Anonymous. We're everywhere. Anywhere we go, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is there. We got to take a trip to England earlier this year and to go visit my wife's family. And then we went off to Paris and did a couple other things out there. But I got to walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in England. And again, same thing. I'm feeling like it's different. What is this? And coffee maker comes around, gives me a big hug. First thing they said to me, they said, where are you from? Because they could tell when I guess the way I was dressed or whatever. I hadn't even said a word yet. Where are you from? And I said, I'm from California. And they, you know what they said? They said, welcome home. Same thing they said to me when I was walking up to Dr. Bob's house in Akron, right? Welcome home. Same thing you guys said to me every time I showed up to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome back. Keep coming back. Welcome home. Last house on the block. Thank God for this house. Thank God for this house. It's made me who I am today. It's paying dividends through my entire family. My children at home right now are healing and they're prospering because of you guys. You know, And when I say you guys, that I'm talking about everybody. I'm talking about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm just about there. I could keep going, but I'm going to end it right there. So thank you so much.
Thanks for bringing your A game.